This is the BBC third program. We present A Very Great Man Indeed, an investigation for radio written by Henry Reed. The music composed by Donald Swan, with Hugh Burton as Herbert Reeves, a scholar.
The late Richard Schoen has been justly called the poet's novelist. Other and abler pens than ours have done justice to the work that earned for him the title of the Balzac of the 20th century. It is now 10 years and more since he died, but his great series of novels are still strikingly relevant to our predicament today. Indeed, Schoen may certainly be regarded as the noblest precursor of the second Elizabethan age. But his literary glory is not our theme, nor is it any part of our aim to trace the magical spell that Schoen has cast over his younger fellow craftsmen, though it may be fairly said that scarcely a novelist since has been untouched by his influence. We have only to think of the late Sir Hugh Walpole, cut off in the plenitude of his powers, or of Mr. Graham Greene and Mr. Angus Wilson, happily still with us. The glory of all this, we have said, is not our theme, which is no less than the man himself. Even so, it is in Schoen's actual fiction that we find our first hint for an attempted discovery of the man behind the words. The first clue, we might almost say. At the close of one of his earliest novels, The Hot and the Cold, Mrs. Heppel and Peter Scutcheon are discussing the death of the man they have both, in their different ways, loved. It may be remarked in passing that Schoen's narrative style has not, in The Hot and the Cold, perhaps shaken itself quite free of certain early influences. No matter. It is a young man's book. Mrs. Heppel is talking with Scutcheon.
But no, dear friend.
She all but breathlessly flung the small word at him, so that he, poor Scutcheon, could not fail, almost pointedly, to stare at her tone.
You could always find him if you wanted to, even though the dear fellow isn't here anymore.
Scutcheon was ruefully to admit to himself for many years after that it was her fine eyes rather than her fine words that did it for him. Which didn't, however, at that moment keep him from all doubtfully putting to her,
"You could, you mean, find him in..."
"Yes?"
she smilingly invited.
"In The Horrid Mother, you mean?"
he had all but pronounced, when Mrs. Heppel swept The Horrid Mother so magnificently out of the way. And with her, as Scutcheon forcibly sensed, the horrid brothers and sisters as well, that it was some small minute before he, still hazily, disengaged that she had done this only to sweep them with one of her high gestures ever so gloriously back again.
"Then who, my dear..."
he was just about to face her with, when she, instead, faced him, and quite fairly and squarely let him have it.
"All of them. The whole jolly lot,"
she radiantly brought out.
"They all had a parcel of him. He was never, poor fellow, his own. They divided him, oh, but with an unscrupulousness, among themselves. You'd only ever understand him if, quite triumphantly, you understood the whole family as well."
"Which,"
he pertinently blurted,
"I almost, you know, don't."
The end.
Let us confess it frankly that that early passage seemed to offer us the very key with which in the end we might unlock Schoen's own heart. "You'd only ever understand him if, quite triumphantly, you understood the whole family as well." Yes. Upon that hint, we sought. We knew, of course, that the unpleasant family in The Hot and the Cold was in no sense a picture of Schoen's own family. Nevertheless, his family was our starting point. And looking back now, it is a not unmoving experience to recall our first venture into the Schoen penumbra. The day of our first encounter with Mr. Stephen Schoen, the novelist's one surviving brother, happily still with us. An interview so graciously accorded, so immediately illuminating, and so reassuring about the soundness of our method. It was a day in April. We were received by Mrs. Stephen Sherwin, at all times so unsparing in her efforts to help us.
Is that Mr. Reeve?
Yes, I'm Herbert Reeve. Good afternoon. I think you're expecting me.
The door isn't locked. Would you mind just pushing it, please, and slipping through? Please? So as not to let Muffy out?
Yes, I... Certainly, I can try. Oh, hello, Puddy.
Thank you so much, Mr. Reeve. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You think me so very rude, but I can't move for P-U-S-S-I-E-S. And I daren't let them out or leave them in the kitchen while I'm cooking their tea.
No, no, of course not.
And I don't like them to get upstairs to my husband while he's in bed.
So?
He speaks a little sharply to them at times. And they mind, you know.
Oh, I do hope Mr. Sherwin isn't ill.
Oh, no, Mr. Reeve. Now, Pussy, if I put you down, you'll promise not to go and climb in the sink. What? The sink? Yes, the hut of where we were then. And do I be a best girl? Oh, no, Mr. Reeve, my husband's not ill. He just prefers to stay in bed all the time. Could you just hand Buffy to me, please, Mr. Reeve? Mm-hmm. That one.
There.
Good in your eyes, Muffy. Thank you very much. It's so difficult keeping an eye on all six of them. I expect you'd rather go up to my husband's bedroom. It's the second on the right on the first landing. Don't be nervous, will you?
Nervous, Mrs. Sherwin?
Well, I'm afraid it is true. He did throw some small object or other at poor Miss Edwards when she was writing her book about Richard.
Oh.
But it really wasn't what people said, Mr. Reeve. They do exaggerate. It was more of a large teacup, actually. Oh, no, not just now, Pussy. And, Mr. Reeve, please don't broach the subject too soon, if you don't mind.
Oh, of course not.
And would you mind stepping over Millie? Yes. She's on the third step from the top. She always likes to sit there when she's making her kitties. And if you wouldn't mind just creeping into the bedroom so she can't follow you.
Of course. The second on the right, I think you said.
On the first landing, yes. I'm so sorry there's no carpet on the stairs, but my husband always likes to hear people approaching. Snowdove. Oh, Snowdove. Snowdove! Where are you, darling?
No one could approach a first meeting with a novelist brother without memories crowding into the mind of... Oh, hello, Millie. Nice pussy. May I step over you? A big pussy, aren't you? Without memories crowding into the mind of the touching pictures of brotherhood that occur in the later novels. It is a not unmoving experience to recall our first knock at the door.
Darling.
Good afternoon, Mr. Sherwin.
I am not ill, Mr. Reeves, if that is what you are thinking. Not at all.
Oh, I thought perhaps seeing...
You may disregard that, Mr. Reeves. I spend most of my time here. I've never seen any point in getting up if there's nothing to get up for.
No.
And there's been nothing to get up for in my life for a very long time.
Oh, I'm very sorry.
Mr. Reeves, I am less than the dust in this house, Mr. Reeves.
Oh, I...
You came to ask about my late brother?
Well, sir, if you...
Yes. Others have come here for the same purpose. I am less than the dust in this house, Mr. Reeves. I have always been less than the dust. Do sit down if you would find it more comfortable. Just remove my inhibition symptoms and anxiety off the chair, if you please.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
Yes. And speaking of chariot wheels, Mr. Reeves, I may say my late brother rode roughshod over my feelings on many an occasion. You know only the outer rind of my brother, Mr. Reeves, the gaudy self-display of his so-called literary writings. But inside of that outer rind, Mr. Reeves, many very, very strange things beat, ticked, and pulsed.
Oh.
Was there any particular question you wanted to ask me?
Well, sir, if you wouldn't mind...
Hey, Mr. Reed, would you be so kind as to pass me that jug of water from the chest of drawers, please? I like to have it by me.
Yes, sir. Certainly. There.
Thank you.
Well, of course, Mr. Stern, there are many things I would like to ask about.
I drink a great deal of water, Mr. Reed. Lying here, quietly thinking, staring into the past, weighing very carefully and thoughtfully the rights of one thing and the wrongs of another, I drink a great deal of water.
Yes,
A very great deal. It wasn't a nice thing to say, was it? I deeply regret it.
Oh, no, Mr. Trump, please say anything you wish.
And to say it for brother, a younger brother. He said to me, if I hadn't Steve, somebody else would have. He knew I hated being called Steve.
You mean that Richard, Mr. Sherwin, said...
Do not think for a single instant, Mr. Reeves, that it was the low, common debauchery of it I minded. No. It was his making up nasty little poems about it I objected to.
Poems? I'd no idea Richard Sherwin wrote poetry. Oh, one might have guessed that, of course, he has been justly called the poet's novelist.
A private book of them in his own handwriting.
Good heavens. And are they extant?
I wouldn't like to say what they are. I was looking at them only yesterday morning, and they made me feel bitter, aggrieved, and depressed. For me and for him, that he should have sunk so low as to write such things. A brother.
Do you think I might be allowed to see them?
I would have to know you a great deal better than I do as yet, Mr. Reeve.
Reeve is the name.
Whose?
Mine.
Yes, I suppose it is. Perhaps I shall show them to you, Mr. Reeve. Perhaps I shan't. Time alone will tell. Mr. Reeve.
Yes, sir?
If you cared to turn your head, Mr. Reeve, you would see a picture hanging on the wall behind it.
Oh, yes.
The woman taken in adultery by Titian, Mr. Reeve. That is the title of that picture. And still it did no good.
I don't quite...
With a brother's wife, too, Mr. Reeve.
Oh, why, I'm deeply sorry, sir.
Oh, I could have borne it. I have borne much in my life. I've had to, of course. But writing unsavory ditties on the subject, shouting them about the place.
Indeed?
Yes, in a cheerful and hilarious fashion, and pretending they were my wife's own words. I like to sleep with Richard better than with poor old Steve. The costness of it all.
Do you mean that Richard Sherwin wrote those words?
Yes. I like to sleep with Richard better than with poor old Steve. Richard doesn't keep telling me just how I make him grieve. And I know when Richard tickles me or bites me on the rump, it isn't for any subconscious reason. He does it to make me jump. Now, Mr. Reed, that's a cruelly unkind remark to make about my subconscious, isn't it? Yes, I never jibed or mocked at his, whatever I get him to do.
But, forgive me, I hope I'm not being impertinent, but I'd never imagined that Richard and...
And my wife, yes. I would find them in this very chamber, Mr. Reed. I was gravely displeased. But it was the nasty remarks in the poem that wounded, grieved, and hurt me. I won't offend your ears by reciting the whole poem.
Oh, please, don't mind.
If poem it can be called, I will content myself with mentioning its concluding lines. So that's why I leave poor old Stephen and hop over to Richard instead. Psychology is all right in the proper place, but I know what I like in... To think of it, Mr. Green. Why, if we don't take our psychology seriously, where are we? Where are we? Nowhere. Nowhere. I've always taken my psychology very seriously. That's why I'm able to do without doctors. I have an anxiety neurosis, Mr. Grief. An anxiety to please. An anxiety to do the very best I can for other people, whoever they may be. But Richard used to take advantage of it. He would take advantage of anybody's. You take advantage of my anxiety neurosis, Richard, I used to say to him. And one day he said, Well, thank God it isn't a you-know-what, he said. And that was a very unkind thing to say also, Mr. Reeves, because he knew as well as I did that I had a you-know-what. Why, Mr. Reeves, in those days I just couldn't step off a moving staircase. I dreaded it, Mr. Reeves, dreaded it. And a lot of sensitive people are just the same. It's not a laughing matter, is it? No, no, no.
No. I'm very sorry of what you told me, Mr. Sherwin. I can understand your distress.
Yes.
All we can tell ourselves, I suppose, is that genius is a law unto itself.
Mr. Reeve.
Yes, Mr. Sherwin?
Mr. Reeve, when you go away, will you be so very kind as to just slide yourself round the door so that the cat, Millie, does not get into the room?
Oh, of course, sir. I do hope I haven't...
Oh, don't regard that as an intimation to depart, Mr. Reeve. Please resume your seat.
Oh, thank you.
I suppose you've interviewed other people on the subject of my late brother.
Well, I intend to, of course. I have plans to call on a great number of people.
I wonder if you'd be visiting the... Oh, but no, of course you wouldn't have heard of them.
Whom are you referring to, sir?
I never met them myself, of course. I just knew the address. That was all.
Well, sir, perhaps you would...
I've no doubt they knew more about him than his unfortunate family ever did. He probably wasn't as mean with them as he was with us, or as ruthless.
With whom, Mr. Shine?
The two Miss Birthdays, B-U-R-K-L-E-Y. You haven't met them, I suppose. Miss Adela Berkeley and Miss Elizabeth Berkeley.
No, but...
If the address, Mr. Reeve, is in Shepherd Market and runs as follows. 17 Beach Street, W-1.
Just let me... Write that down, will you? It's so kind of you.
I suppose you will never visit me again, Mr. Reed.
Well, if I may, sir, I should be honored to call at any time you'll allow me.
Then pray do, Mr. Reed. I'm anxious to do my best for you, or for anyone in the whole wide world, if it comes to that. It's what I live for, after all. I have no doubt other qualities of my late brother will recur to my mind at intervals.
Well, what you have already told me does, of course, to some extent... upset certain preconceived ideas I had.
Yes.
But no doubt things will fall into their place. Your brother, after all, Mr. Sherwin, was probably the greatest literary figure of our...
Mr. Reeve.
Yes, sir?
Mr. Reeve, when you go away, would you be so very kind as to just slide yourself round the door so that the cat, Millie, does not get into the room?
Oh. Yes, of course, sir. Certainly. Well, I must be off. Thank you so much, Mr. Sherwin, for all your very great kindness to me.
Yes.
It was, as we have said, a not unmoving experience to see for the first time in the flesh the Sherwin family face. For clearly, in the features of the great novelist's brother, Mr. Stephen Sherwin...
Oh, so sorry, Pussy. Oh, dear.
How was he, Mr. Reeve? Forgive me for not asking you into the kitchen, but pussies are having their tea. How was he?
He was most kind and helpful.
Did he mention his brother at all, I wonder? He's always so very reticent. And I'm afraid there was sometimes bad blood between them, Mr. Reeve.
Yes, he was very frank, I'm afraid, Mrs. Shine.
He is nowadays sometimes, yes. No, Pussy, of course it was a long time ago. I've quite forgiven him.
Forgiven?
Oh, one does, you know, Mr. Reeve. One has to. And really, he's a very simple man, my husband. I hope you didn't get the idea that he took Richard's wife away from Richard.
No, Mr. Sherwin said nothing that even made me suspect such a thing.
Oh, no, it was she who led my husband astray. Poor Richard was very upset he'd never enter this house, you know.
What? Really?
No, not today, Pussy. But of course, Mr. Reeve, it's far in the past. Better to forget it. You will come and see us again when the maid is in and I can give you tea.
Thank you very much.
And, Mr. Reeve, if you could just go through the door without opening it, Muffy has got her eye on it. Now I thought a Muffy promised to be our best girl in the room.
A full consideration of the great richness of Richard Sherwin's domestic relationships will perhaps have to wait until later. It is even possible that complete and accurate details are not yet available.
What Professor Grilling has called the brother motive in Schoen's later work offers the student particularly fascinating, if somewhat baffling, material. It is, of course, but the other side of the sister motive in the novels of his early middle period. In The Up and the Down, for example, or The Light and the Home, to name but two. But, as many a critic has asked, where did this intimate knowledge come from? For Schoen had no sister. We think we are at last able to cast light upon that question. It was indeed with something akin to certainty that at Mr. Stephen Schoen's suggestion, we approached the presence of the Mrs. Adela and Elizabeth Berkeley. Here, surely, if anywhere...
You'd think it would never stop, really. My sister says she's never known rain like it.
No, indeed.
Beg pardon?
I said, no, indeed.
Yes.
You knew Mr. Schoen very well, I believe, Miss Berkeley.
Beg pardon?
I imagine you knew Mr. Schoen very well.
Well, you know. Of course, he was always very nice.
Oh, yes, everyone says so.
Very nice indeed, and considerate, too.
Did he discuss his work very much, I wonder?
Beg pardon?
Did he ever vouchsafe any information about what he was working on?
Well, he was always very nice, of course.
I meant, did he... I hope all this doesn't seem impertinent, Miss Berkeley.
Beg pardon?
I hope I'm not taking up too much of your time.
Oh, no, certainly not. Did you know Dickie Schoen at all?
Oh, was he ever called Dickie? I didn't know that.
Oh, well, no, not really. Of course, I usually called him Mr. Schoen. So did my sister. He really liked her the best, I think. She could be here by now.
Yes, I look forward to meeting her.
She's blonde, of course.
I beg your pardon?
Almost platinum, really. But it is the natural colour, really it is. People don't always believe it, but it is. You look at the roots close to.
Ah, yes. No, I never knew Schoen myself. I was rather of a younger generation, I'm afraid.
Oh, yes, I could tell you were young.
In fact, I never actually saw him. But I sometimes think that people of my generation appreciate him more than his own contemporaries did.
Beg pardon?
I mean that today one is perhaps beginning to appreciate his real size.
But Mr. Schoen was never a large gentleman.
No, his genius, I mean.
Beg pardon?
His genius.
Was Mr. Schoen a genius?
Well, I suppose it depends on one's standards.
Beg pardon?
I've always thought him a genius, certainly.
Fancy. Well, he never said so.
Oh, no, of course not. He was well known for his modesty.
His what?
His modesty.
Oh, no, not Mr. Schoen.
Yes, surely,
oh,
everyone.
Oh, no. Mind you, he was very nice, but he was never modest. He was very nice, but he was never modest. Dee?
Huh?
Oh, I was just speaking to Joey. He's just behind you, our canary. Dee?
Joey, Abby.
Oh.
It's running out of breath.
Hello, dear. The gentleman's called. That's my sister. I'll tell her. And I'll put the kettle on. You'd like a cup of tea, I expect.
Thank you very much.
I'll send Betty in.
Tweet, tweet. It is an interesting fact that though Schoen always preserved a scrupulous modesty in estimating his own work among his fellow craftsmen and in intellectual society generally, he was less reticent among humbler people. Indeed, nothing is perhaps more revealing of the true nature of the man than this. Tweet, we need not despise him for it. In simple and unaffected company, he could appear in what someone, speaking of Beethoven's rondos, has called an unbuttoned mood. That is all it means.
Hello?
Pete? Oh, good afternoon.
I'm Betty. Pleased to meet you. Bobby's putting the kettle on.
Bobby?
Oh, of course, I expect you're still calling her Adela. It's a pretty name, isn't it?
I've put the kettle on, dear. Betty, the gentleman was saying Mr. Schoen was a modest gentleman.
He wasn't, was he, dear?
Modest? My word, no. Nobody could say that.
And he always liked all the lights on.
Well, of course, many writers have had an unaccountable fear of the dark.
Beg pardon? I suppose you must have been a great friend of Mr. Schoen.
No, dear. The gentleman's writing a book about him.
Writing a book about Dickie Schoen?
Fancy.
A reading book?
Well, I hope somebody will read it.
Oh, I'm sure somebody will.
I hope you'll allow me to send you a copy when it's finished.
Oh, thank you. That would be kind. We could do with a book about the place.
It's a thing I've never read, is the book.
Oh, I've read one.
Oh, you do? When?
Oh, when I was in the hospital.
Was it nice?
Not really, no.
No, I've heard other people say that.
Tweet, tweet.
Well, if you do mention Dickie Showen in this book, you will say how very nice he always was, won't you?
And considerate.
Oh, yes, put that in. He was very considerate.
Not like the one who came with him the first few times, the one who never even gave his name.
Oh,
how extremely uncivil.
Beg pardon?
I said, how uncivil.
Well, some of them don't, of course. But this was a really nasty man.
I wonder who it could have been.
Dickie always called him T.H.T., so he did.
Oh, I see. Yes, that must have been T.H. Powers, the novelist.
Was he a genius as well?
I'm afraid not. Of course, when he was younger, there were people who thought he might go quite a long way.
Well, it wasn't for the want of trying if he didn't. Hush, dear.
No, indeed. Actually, I'm calling on him in a few days' time. I'll tell him I've had the pleasure of meeting you.
Oh, no, I shouldn't do that if I were you. He mightn't like it, you know. A lot of them don't.
Oh? One is always venturing onto dangerous ground in drawing parallels between an author's fiction and what we know of his life. But it seems to us reasonably clear that the two Miss Berkleys, so courageously living out their spinsterhood in their little flat in Shepherd Market, London, must have provided at least the donne, or hint, for the two lonely sisters, Mona and Rosa Stanmore, in the novel called The Quick and the Slow. We are thinking especially of the wonderful dying fall of the closing pages of that moving story. There's silence between them.
Surely it could not be allowed to go on forever, thought Mona. But how to break it? At last, not quite looking in Rosa's direction, she said,
"Did you have a pleasant walk, darling?"
Rosa seemed to smolder for a moment. Then even that sullen fire seemed to die out, and she replied firmly,
"At least I did no harm. The Earl's Court Road was not disturbed in any way by my passage along it. I went into the park, sat, watched the birds making their nests, read 14 pages of Liaison Dangereuse, and returned as I went. I was at no point approached by any undesirable stranger."
Mona threw her arms round her sister.
"Darling, don't,
she whispered.
"Don't give way to bitterness. I know you think that life has passed us by, but don't be bitter, darling."
Rosa gently but firmly disengaged herself and stood up. She looked coldly down into her sister's face, as into that of a stranger. Then she said, quietly and slowly,
"Bitterness, Miss Stanmore. What have we to be bitter about?"
The end.
These analogies, of course, must not be pressed too far, if only in deference to the living, many of whom are happily still with us. Above all, we must not forget that the aim of all biographical study is, now as ever, the exact and objective ascertainment of established facts. And none can be too humble.
I did, yes. Yes, I did.
And I understand that you acted as Mr. Showen's valet for a considerable number of years.
I did, yes.
You stayed with him for about 12 years, all told.
I did, yes.
You joined him, I think, in 1920?
Yes, I did.
I believe you looked after him during his illness in 1924.
Yes, I did.
And then you went with him to Austria when he recovered?
Yes, I did.
I gather from his letters that you sometimes accompanied him on his evening walks in Salzburg and Vienna.
Yes, I did.
And that you both greatly enjoyed this jaunt abroad.
I did, yes.
You also became Mr. Stern's chauffeur when he bought a motor car in 1927.
I did, yes.
And drove him on many occasions down to his country home.
I did, yes.
You preferred the car to the train.
I did, yes.
And you always found Mr. Stern a kind and considerate employer.
Yes, I did.
Information of this kind is, needless to say, the very stuff of biography. It is the more subjective impressions that we must beware of. especially when a man has, like Schoen, been greatly loved by the world. It may be added that Schoen returned that love, aye, and more than returned it. One of our modern neo-pessimists has remarked with characteristic acidity, "L'enfer, c'est les autres." Hell consists of other people. We know what Schoen's comment on that would have been. Yes, he would have said with his familiar wry smile, yes, but so does heaven. We have often imagined him saying that. Such a man, and this is our point, awakens an affection among his fellows that may blind them a little to his faults. It was with eager interest that we looked forward to talking with the novelist T.H. Powers. Schoen was, of course, considerably older than Powers, and Mr. Powers' novels had never reached anything like the large public enjoyed by those of Jern himself. So that Schoen had become, quite naturally, a hero to the younger aspirant in his own lovely art. We were not unprepared for a little hero worship on the part of Mr. Powers. And why should we despise unaffected hero worship? God help us.
So you're writing a book on old Dick Schoen, Mr. Reeves. Yes. Not much of a subject, is it?
Well,
have you ever thought of writing a book on Robert Louis Stevenson?
No.
That might be a good subject for you, no? Or Meredith, even. Not much been done on him. Gissing might be interesting, too. Or Henry James, of course, always there. And Hardy. No, perhaps not Hardy. Too many books on him as it is.
Well, I feel Richard Schoen will last me a very long time, you know, sir. It's a fascinating theme, his life, isn't it?
Is it? Yes, perhaps it is. The poet's novelist, what? You a poet?
No.
Novelist?
No, I once... No, I'm not.
Ah, then you start with certain obvious advantages.
Well, I try to think so.
Oh, yes, I should. Well, Mr. Reaper, I will, of course, be glad to give you any help I can about Dick Schoen.
Oh, thank you. I felt sure you would, sir.
Oh, yes. Yes. Where to begin? Schoen... Richard Schoen knew me rather well. Rather well. He liked me partly, I think, because I was younger than he was. He liked people to confide in him, you know?
Yes, he must have exercised the most compelling influence over people younger than himself.
Well, it would never have occurred to me to put it quite like that, you know. He absorbed a good deal from other people, you might say. Yes, shall we put it like that? Yes, a great absorber. A magpie, a dear old magpie sort of chap. You couldn't help liking him quite in a way. One would find him imitating one's gestures, you know, one's turns of phrases, one. Yes, imitating.
You mean for fun?
Fun? Good God, no. No, I mean that he would absorb from his friends whatever he could. Je prends mon bien où je le trouve sort of business. Yes. You probably noticed how very derivative his novels are.
Oh, no.
I wonder if you've read a little thing of mine called The Dark Backwood and Abysm.
Oh, yes, of course, sir. I enjoyed it very much.
Still readable, is it? Good. Well, you'll probably have noticed that a good deal of Schoen's novel, The Floor and the Ceiling, came from it.
But, if I may say so, sir, The Floor and the Ceiling was published several years earlier than your own splendid novel, Mr. Powers.
Oh, yes. We all know that, but you didn't imagine it was written earlier, did you? Oh, no. I withheld my own novel for several years, Mr. Reaper. I usually do. It is my want.
Of course, I didn't know that.
It is my way. I've never believed in rushing into print. Rather a perfectionist, you know what? Rather a perfectionist. Schoen wasn't. Of course, I was very, very, very fond of the old thing.
Yes, I believe everyone was.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. Of course, one can see the significance of it all now, what with the advance of psychiatry and all that.
The significance of...
The old boy's imitativeness, you know. Yes. Yes, you know all about that, of course, you moderns, what?
Well, I don't, I'm afraid.
Oh, but surely. Oh, come, come.
No, really, sir, I don't.
Oh, dear. Well, how shall I put it? Yummy. L'impuissance, shall we call it?
Good gracious.
A great worry to the elbow, of course. But very imitative people often are peu incapable in that way, shall we say? And, of course, we all knew about poor old Fern.
Well, really, Mr. Powers, that isn't at all the impression I've gathered from some people I've talked to lately about Fern.
Well, of course, Mr. Heap, you doctors have superior sources of information to mine. I was merely...
Oh, but please, sir, don't misunderstand me, I do beg you. It was only that...
But tell me, Mr. Heap.
Yes?
Tell me, have you ever, I wonder, thought of writing the biography of a living author?
Well, no, never. You see, I've been interested in Sherwin almost since I was a boy.
He's a boy's writer, of course. So you've never thought of a living author as a subject?
No, I'm afraid not.
Interesting, though. Yeah.
I do agree, of course, that a living subject could be very engrossing.
Very. Very. There have been very good books about living authors. Some of the best, in fact. After all, think of the advantages. You can consult with the subject himself. It could be very, very interesting.
Yes.
Especially if he's in the habit of keeping diaries and is willing to supervise the work and that sort of thing. Do you enjoy reading personal memoirs, Mr. Green?
Yes, very much. It's been a great setback to me that there are no real Sherwin diaries.
No, there have been nothing in them, my dear boy. Just one luncheon engagement after another with this or that rather dubious member of the aristocracy. He couldn't resist the title.
Well, he is said to have refused a knighthood.
Said, yes. But does one really know if he was ever offered one?
Oh, yes.
When?
The year after he was awarded the Nobel Prize.
Some writers have refused even that award, you know, Mr. Weave.
Refused the Nobel?
Oh, yes. However, you were saying that you liked memoirs. I have myself written about 22 folio notebooks full of memoirs. I've knocked about quite rich, no? I think you might find them rather fascinating. A great many interesting people have been numbered among my friends.
Yes. Oh, of course.
Yes.
I've quite forgotten how rude of me.
No.
Two friends of yours asked to be remembered to you.
Oh, how kind, my dear fellow. Both of them and of you. Who were the dear creatures?
The Miss Berkeleys.
Who?
Miss Adela and Miss Elizabeth Berkeley. They live in Beach Street, just off...
Mr. Treves.
Like, well, really, sir, they...
Mr. Treves. Is this blackmail?
Mr. Parr.
You despicable thing. Is this blackmail, sir?
It is, unfortunately, quite true that Sherwin's surviving diaries are little more than engagement books. But they reveal a good deal of the rich social texture of Sherwin's life. For over 20 years, he lunched or dined out almost every day during the London season. Many of the people whose names he noted in these little pocket volumes are, alas, no more. But his surviving friends have told us much about the part he played in the dazzling political and social life he so well portrays in such novels as The Bang and The Whimper. We are especially indebted to Lady Blackie, who can look back on more than 70 years of social life in London, and into whose clusters of celebrated guests so inevitably drift was drawn.
No, no. Don't put your cigar out, Mr. Reeves. I like the smell.
Thank you.
A little more brandy.
Thank you.
I don't drink myself anymore, of course, but they tell me it's quite nice. Sir Edward Buller used to tell me it was the best brandy he'd ever tasted. And to this day, Evelyn drinks quantities of it. Quantities.
It's excellent.
What?
It's excellent.
Well, I'm so sorry to make you shout, but I'm getting so deaf these days.
Did Richard Sherwin drink very much, Lady Blackie?
Did he what?
Drink very much.
Well, it's very odd you should ask that. It was always a bit of a mystery to me. I had always been told he never drank at all. And certainly the first time he came here, he never did. I remember it was a little dinner party I gave for him and... Charlie Chaplin. Just a few friends we had in. Willie Maugham, I think, and Margot and Max, and Mr. Gordon Bottomley, and Sir Flinders Pichot, such a clever man. What a loss. And I forget who else was there. Ellen Kelly, I expect he usually was. And Mr. Sherwin never drank at all on that occasion. But certainly he always drank a very great deal whenever he came afterwards.
Indeed.
And very often he seemed to have drunk a very great deal before he got here. Still, people are very unpredictable about drink, aren't they? One day when Mr. Bernard Shaw came to luncheon, I saw him looking at a glass of burgundy quite longingly.
Really?
Yes. And once Mr. Dylan Thomas came and drank water.
Can you remember what Sherwin used to talk about, I wonder?
Huh? Oh, but friends, you know, usually talk about our friends. He was always very nice about everybody. He did once make rather an unkind remark about Bosie. But people did, you know, and I don't think Bosie heard.
An unkind remark about whom, Lady Blackie?
Bosie.
Bosie?
What?
Bosie who, Lady Blackie?
Yes, Bosie. Do you get on with him?
I don't think I know who you are.
I'm so sorry to make you shout, Mr. Reed. Something seems to have gone wrong with my little hearing aid again. Sometimes if I smack it on the table. Yeah, that's better. Yes, that's much better. I can hear you perfectly now. What? Sorry. Oh, yes, I think so, too. I did at the time. It was obvious. But I'm sorry you didn't like poor little Bosie.
I didn't say that, Lady Blackie. I was merely asking who he was.
What?
Bosie.
Oh, I never minded at all, of course not.
But please forgive me, Lady Blackie. Whom do you mean when you say Bosie?
They both were. I knew all along.
You said Richard Sherwin once...
Yes, it does sometimes.
...made an unkind remark.
At other times, it's as clear as a day in June or July.
We must not, of course, exaggerate the social element in Sherwin's life. We remember that in the novel The Top and the Bottom, the hero, after each of his excursions into high life, returns to the bosom of his family to make, as he puts it, a fresh start, nine times in all. It is perhaps something more than a coincidence that in our studies, Sherwin's own family has provided for us a similar point de repère.
Good afternoon, Mr. Reed. Who let you in?
The maid, Mr. Sherwin.
Yes. Mr. Reeve.
Yes, sir?
My wife has left me, Mr. Reeve.
Left you, Mr. Sherwin? Oh, dear, I am sorry, sir. What a dreadful thing.
All of a piece, isn't it, Mr. Reeve? It all fits. How good of you to call. The influence of a dead person can do a great deal.
I don't quite understand, Mr. Sherwin.
My late brother. His spirit, as you see, lingers on. In the watches of the night, Mr. Reeve, I sometimes hear him mocking me with his nasty scurril.
His nasty what?
Scurril. All of a piece throughout. Imagine it, Mr. Reeve, the empty house, the loneliness, day after day. If I even had a television machine.
I'm terribly sorry. Is there anything I can do?
Oh, no. It was to be... I must bear it with fortitude, that's all. I hope your researches are proceeding satisfactorily, Mr. Reeve. How did you get on with Miss Tablet?
Miss Tablet?
I thought I gave you her address.
No, it was the two Miss Berkleys. And very kind and helpful they were, too. I'm most grateful, sir. But who is Miss...
Tablet?
I don't think I...
Well, it's of no consequence. Perhaps I shouldn't have mentioned her.
But, dear Mr. Sherwin...
No, it would have been better not. Hilda Tablet, the name was.
Hilda Tablet?
Yes. The lady music writer.
Oh, I'd no idea you meant her.
You know about her and Richard?
No. I didn't even know they knew each other.
Oh. Perhaps he said he wanted to marry her. He swore it. Some didn't believe him, some did. He didn't always tell lies. Not that I ever liked her. I could never have married her, quite apart from her being a lady music writer and the noise that that must entail. She remains a spinster to this day.
Yes, I knew, of course, that she was unmarried.
Yes. Her daughter is said to be a very nice girl, however. I, of course, have no views on the matter.
But, Mr. Sherwin...
And what else have you been doing, I wonder, while I have been lying deserted, alone and bereft here?
Please, let me ask one question about Miss
Cass. It is a change to meet anybody as interested in the past as you are, Mr. Lee. I am devoted to the study of the past myself. Its rights and wrongs I brood a great deal over. I sometimes sit up in bed and look straight at it, Mr. Reeve, with a steady gaze, fixedly. The future I disregard. One cannot have eyes in the back of one's head, can one?
No.
And my late brother's literary executrix. You've seen her, of course. Miss Rich.
I'm seeing her next week. It's very difficult to make an appointment with her. She's so busy the whole time.
You will find her very interesting, no doubt. My brother wrote a poem about her, too.
Really? About his literary executrix?
Well, she was his secretary as well, you know, and he would have written poems about anybody.
I wonder if you recall it.
Extremely well, Mr. Reed. My memory has very little amiss with it. The poem began, Little Miss Rich. And the rest of it, Mr. Reeve, I would not recite to anybody. Though it was quite short as far as it went.
I see.
A mere distich. And whom else will you be visiting?
Well, in about a fortnight's time, I hope to be able to get down to Bulford, to the other part of the Sherwin family. And, of course, the native haunts of Sherwin himself.
You're going to see my other brother's widow and all that dreadful brood of children?
Yes. Mrs. Edward Sherwin has kindly invited me to stay for a few days.
But then I had better accompany you.
That would be delightful, of course, but...
I couldn't dream of letting you submit yourself to such an ordeal without my protection. I hope your life is insured, Mr. Reeve.
Yes.
Good. But I had better come, all the same.
But...
Oh, don't take me. A change will do me harm, no doubt, but no matter... I think I would like to be alone now, Mr. Reeve. Disregard completely what I may have said about Miss Tablet. I'm sure I've been misinformed about her. She lives at 109 Coptic Street. What in goodness name are all those cats mewing about her? Look.
Oh.
Is that you, Mr. Reed? I'm so sorry. I was out. I had a little shopping to do. When you finish up there, do please come and have a cup of tea with me and Putty. It's not his birthday.
Thank you. Mr. Sherwin.
Yes, Mr. Reed?
It's Mrs. Sherwin.
Oh. Well, she must have come back again, I suppose. That's all. No matter.
Here was a slight dilemma. Mr. Sherwin had given us strong and interesting hints about Miss Hilda Tablet, the distinguished composeress. He had also, however, seemed to urge us to avoid contact with her. What were we to do? For clearly, it was not a problem that would solve itself.
You can relate that it's all in you. Play as far as the eye could reach. Come in, come in. Excuse a moment, do sit down. She's just getting it right. Must go out for just a sec. Now. Entirely covered with skeletons.
Good, lovely.
And he took it for a battlefield, for a battlefield.
Oh, no, Elsa, damn it, for heaven's sake, please. I've told you before, this isn't Madame Butterfly you're singing.
I cannot help.
Of course you can help, just silly little Dotty. I told you 100 times, throw your voice at the note by all means. But for God's sake, remember to miss it.
But I cannot sing so always out of tune like this.
Tune? Did I hear the word tune?
Es ist nicht ausdrucksvoll.
Ausdrucksvoll?
Ja, es ist nicht ausdrucksvoll.
Elsa, I've told you what would happen if I ever heard you use that word in here again. Excuse me a moment, Mr. Thing. Yes. Ausdrucksvoll, indeed. Dear God, save me from madness.
Shall I make some tea and toast?
Yes, yes, make some tea and toast. It's all you're good for. Hello, Mr. Reeve. Have a cigarette?
I do hope I haven't come too early, Miss Tablet. You did say 4.
Perfectly okay. Sorry about Elsa. Been rehearsing all afternoon. New piece of mine. Like what you heard of it?
Very much. Though, of course, it's difficult for me to judge.
Oh, without the orchestra, you mean? Yes, yes. Actually, it'll only be 4 trombones, 1 harmonium and a mandolin. But I agree, it doesn't sound much on the piano.
Who are the words by?
Well, that bit was Schopenhauer, of course.
Ah, yes.
I've assembled the words myself from here and there. 8 chunks of them. Isaiah, Emily Dickinson, St. John of the Cross, Schopenhauer, Herrick, Cyril Connolly, Homer and Paul Dane. Oh, it'll be all right, I think. It's called Nocturne. You look nice. You write, I think you said in your letter.
Yes,
I wouldn't like to do me a libretto on Gilles for mon aïeux by any chance.
Well, I'm afraid it's not quite my life.
Oh, well, never mind. You wanted to talk about Dick Schoen.
Yes, if you...
Sure. Elsa, don't bring in the tea till I call. Mr. Reeve and I don't wish to be interrupted.
Yahoo!
Yes, Yahoo! And don't think what you look as if you're thinking. Huh. Nice girl. Mad, of course. Like her?
Yes, I...
Oh, she's all right. Good voice, too. If only she didn't make everything sound like a cross between Brahms and Benjamin Britten. Insofar as it's possible to distinguish between the two, of course.
She's your daughter, I suppose.
My what?
Your daughter.
Oh, that's a good one. I give you 9 marks for that. Oh, she's been taken for my niece before now by a few nice-minded people. Oh, but that's a new one on me. Well, well.
Well, I'm very sorry.
Don't give it a thought. You know, you look rather like Dick Schoen.
Look like?
Well, no, not really, I suppose. Still, I'm glad it's you writing a book about him. Most writer chaps are so ugly. You know all about him and me, of course.
Not...
Well, I mean, you know what he did with me.
No.
I'm Madeleine, in the head and the heart.
I didn't know. No, Miss Tablet.
Oh, I never minded. I didn't really give him the push as hard as all that, of course. Well, there was never any question, of course. Still, he did come rather a smacker over it, poor devil.
I knew that he had been in love with you, Miss Tablet.
Yes. Yes. Love. Yes, he was in love with me. I was not able to return that love, Mr. Breve.
No.
But I respected it. I was honored by it. And of course, I never minded about Madeleine. Good book, I thought.
Oh, very. But forgive my mentioning it, Miss Tablet, but Madeleine in The Head and the Heart is actually dead, you know, before the book opened.
Yes, well, there you are. There it is. Or was, rather. I was quite proud, really. One always is. I regarded it as a sort of, well, a sort of enshrinement. That sort of colony, you know. And after all, it was a two-way traffic. Hell, you can't get away from the soul, can you?
Gilda?
What?
Would the gentleman like a pair of boiled eggs with his tea and toast?
Good heavens, no, girl. Sorry, I mean, you don't want a pair of boiled eggs with your tea and toast, do you?
No.
No. No, no. No, Elsa, of course he doesn't. Go away.
I shall go back to piano.
Listen, Mr. Beat. I'll tell you something about Dick Schoen I've never told anybody else except Elsa. And she didn't know what I meant anyway.
It's very kind of you.
Just shut up and listen, will you? Mr. Beat, in my piano sonata, Opus 43, the basic tone row is F, B, C sharp, G, D, A, F sharp, B flat, G sharp, E, C, D sharp, as you probably know.
Yes.
Well, old Dick Schoen and I used to talk, you know, oh, a hell of a long way into the night sometimes.
Indeed.
Oh, it was only talk, don't get ideas. But it was good talk. Of its kind, it was the best talk I ever remember.
What was it about?
Don't shut up. I'd been working on my sonata all day, I remember. I was bogged down in it. It's such a light, airy sort of a little thing. I expect that will surprise you. Well, don't spread it about, old cock. But, originally, the D sharp in my basic tone roll was where the B flat is now, and vice versa.
Ah.
Well, one night, I was seeing old Dick showing off the premises, and I was just about to shut the front door when I noticed he was still looking up at me from the pavement. We stared at each other in the half dark. What must have been, a good minute, I suppose. Then, very gently, he lifted his hand, and in that quiet, slow way of his, he said, "Good night, Hilda, old chap." Then he went away. I watched him out of sight. I closed the door very gently. And suddenly, I knew.
Knew?
Something told me.
Told you what?
I'd got to swap the bastards over in my basic tone row, B flat and D sharp.
Oh.
That's all. Makes the work, of course. That's Dick showing for you, Mr. Reeve. In an interval of 5 semitones, you may write a whole ruddy book about him, but you'll never get him expressed as briefly as that.
Oh.
Listen, Mr. Reeve, can you turn over?
Turn over?
Music. I'll play that piece for you, so help me. It's about somewhere. I got it out for you. Well, here it is. Damn it, I'll play it. I expect you'll find my writing a bit hard to follow, but just turn the pages over every time I shout out, "Now," will you?
Certainly.
Good. Ready?
Yes.
Right.
This, to us, momentous encounter was to prove the first of many highly delightful visits to Miss Tablet's charming flat in Coptic Street. She was to provide us with much in the way of documentation. Yes, indeed. Documentation is, of course, indispensable to biographical study, and we are especially grateful to Miss Eileen Rich for help on certain difficult technical points connected with our work. Miss Rich, well known for her distinguished work in the Ministry of Home Consumption, was Schoen's secretary in his later years. And during his last illness, she managed to get she was appointed his literary executrix. Schoen cherished always a warm regard for her. Indeed, he is known to have written at least one unpublished poem about her. As we have noted before, only the first half of this has so far come to light. It runs as follows. Little Miss Rich.
I'm sorry to have kept you waiting, Mr. Reeve. I've had a busy morning, and I must get back to my office in 8 minutes' time.
It's most kind of you to see me.
You've doubtless brought a list of the questions you wish to ask?
Well, not exactly a list.
I should have remembered to ask you to do so. I usually do ask that of Mr. Schoen's biographers.
Are there many others, Miss Rich?
What did you wish to know, Mr. Reeve?
I wished, first of all, to ask if the manuscript to Schoen's last unfinished novel is still in your possession.
It is lodged with the bank, of course, but I have charge of it.
Do you think I might, at some convenient time, be allowed to see it?
No, I'm afraid not, Mr. Reeve.
I see. I wonder if you'll give me an idea of when it might become available for inspection.
Oh, yes, certainly. There's a definite date fixed. You'll be able to see it any time after May the 14th, 1992.
Oh, I see. I rather wonder if I shall still be here, too.
We all have to ask ourselves questions like that at times, Mr. Reeve.
One can but hope.
Exactly.
And the legal documents in connection with the Schoen-Eversley lawsuit in the First World War, Can you tell me anything about the accessibility or otherwise of those?
Those, Mr. Reeve, will certainly be available as from February 22nd, 2017.
A.D.?
I beg your pardon?
May I just make a note of that date? February 22nd, 2017. What a charming coincidence. It will be my 103rd birthday.
Indeed. Is there anything else?
I wanted to say that various people have shown me long and rather intimate letters written to them by the late Mr. Sherwin. I hope you'll be so kind as to allow me to quote from them.
I will answer that question by letter, Mr. Reeve, if you will allow me.
Oh, thank you.
So that there may be no mistake.
Thank you. There is just one other point, Miss Little. I'm sorry, Miss Rich. It is rather a problem. I've been shown a group of letters. You may perhaps have seen them yourself. They are the nature of love letters addressed to Sherwin. They're all signed with the initial D. I wonder if by chance you know who D was.
Yes, Mr. Reeve, I do.
I wonder if you'd be willing to divulge her identity.
No, Mr. Reeve, I'm afraid not.
Oh.
And now, if you'll forgive me, I must return to my office. Any help I can give you at any time, of course.
What a theme for the biographer such a man provides. One might spend a lifetime in its pursuit, nor would such a lifetime have been ill-spent. But when all is said and done, there is one spiritual climax to such a quest, which, once achieved, is never quite to be repeated. We mean the first moment when we set foot in a great man's early scenes, his native heath, as it were. To travel down to Mulsett for the first time would in any event have been a not unmoving experience. To make the journey in the company of the poet's brother was a further enrichment. Indeed, our debt to Mr. Stephen Sherwin at all times during our researches would be difficult to express in words.
It is costing me a great deal to make this journey with you, Mr. Reeve, quite apart from the fare.
But
I can never contemplate my brother Edward's enormous family without the extreme of revulsion, disgust, and shame.
But, Mr. Sherwin, it was you yourself who suggested accompanying me.
Oh, I couldn't have let you face the whole monstrous brood unprotected. It would not have been like me.
Are there so very many of them?
Well, there's Edward's widow and 12 children. You may, of course, not consider that many.
12? Are you quite sure, Mr. Sherwin?
Quite sure, Mr. Reeve.
I see. The eldest is now 23, I believe.
Yes. The others are, respectively, 22, 21, 20, 19, 18, 17, 16, 15, 12. My brother was away in Turkey for some time. 11 and 10. The ostentation of it.
Well, some people like large families.
That was not their origin, Mr. Reeve. It was Richard again.
Richard?
You probably are unaware that my brother advertised his intention of leaving the entire fortune that his so-called literary writing brought him in equal parts to all his nephews and nieces. It was nothing more than a low spirit of competition that brought so many horrible little creatures into the world. I refused to engage in it. Which didn't, of course, prevent my brother from writing unseemly verses on the subject.
Indeed?
The Sherwin family, it seems, is apt to fly to great extremes. While Stephen does no more than read little books on how to breed, on the other hand, my brother Ned mistakes his home for an oyster bed. The commonness of it.
And finally, the magic of being in leafy Mulsett itself. This was the air he breathed. Here he was born, here he made his home in later years, and here now were we also, at Throbbing, the charming Palladian house he bought for himself, with its enchanting gardens and lawns. The house he had bequeathed to his brother Edward, alas, no longer with us, and his wife and family. Here they live still, in full proud consciousness of the reverence due to their noble inheritance.
And of course, Mr. Reeve, we can't even get the National Trust to accept it now. Another cup of tea?
Thank you.
I thought you'd like to have tea on the lawn. The weather is so lovely.
Yes, indeed. The view of the hills is beautiful from here, isn't it?
Oh, the hills are perfectly all right, yes. It's the house that is the trouble.
Those hills must be the scene of your boyhood also, Mr. Sherman.
Yes, I entertain extreme dislike of them.
Now, Stephen, dear, don't start grumbling. The landscape is very pretty at this time of year. Ah, now there's my elder daughter, Janet, coming across from the paddock. I do wish she wouldn't slouch so. But, of course, 19 is an awkward age, isn't it? She's at Cambridge, you know.
Yes, I think I knew that.
Come and sit down with us, Janet.
Coming.
May I introduce my daughter, Janet, Mr. Reeve?
How do you do?
How do you do?
Hello, Uncle Stephen.
Hello.
Now, is everyone's cup full?
My cup is always full.
Mr. Reeve is writing a book about Uncle Richard, Janet.
Good God.
Darling, what a thing to say.
A whole book?
Well, one can hardly hope to deal with such a writer in a shorter space.
Can't one? Perhaps not. At any rate, you'll be able to debunk all that stuff about the poet's novelist.
Janet, dear, I suppose you've read all my brother-in-law's books, Mr. Reeve.
Oh, yes, indeed, many times.
How very kind of you. I haven't actually read all through any of them myself. I've hardly had the time, you know.
I don't wonder at that.
But they are good, aren't they, Mr. Reeve? I heard they were very good. People have told me a number of them were very nice indeed.
Well, naturally, I think they're splendid.
I'm so glad. There, Janet. Mr. Reeve says they're very good. Splendid was the word he used.
He may have. Actually, they're not.
Janet, darling, please don't start being unpleasant about your poor uncle's books again. It's so ungrateful.
Ingratitude is by no means uncommon in this family.
I'm sure I don't know how we should have sent you to Cambridge without them.
I've never denied Uncle Dick's capacity as a moneymaker. He produced a very efficient line in consumer goods just at the moment when a rising lower middle class felt it was ripe for culture. Hordes of reviewers from Eton and Oxford were ready to tell them that this was culture, so they bought it.
Oh, dear. I don't know why it is, but young people are so unjust nowadays, aren't they, Mr. Reeve?
Well, a little, perhaps.
Actually, I can't think anybody's been at all unjust to Sherwin. Sherwin's early novel.
Dear, don't call your poor uncle by his surname like that. It sounds so manly.
Oh, sorry, Mother. But Uncle Richard's early promise, such as it was in its completely derivative way, was actually quite fairly evaluated in a footnote in the autumn number of Scrutiny a couple of months after Uncle died.
He was ill such a long time, Mr. Reeve, but so very patient.
So it is given out.
Well, Stephen, dear, he was patient.
Well, I must get back. Will you excuse me, Mr. Reeve?
Oh, certainly, Miss Shane.
What are you doing, dear? Can't you stay and talk to us?
Oh, sorry, Mother. I must get this thing on Flaubert finished.
Are you writing about Flaubert, Miss Shane?
Uh-huh.
An appreciation?
Of a kind. I think I've managed to make a few relevant constatations. See you later.
I hope so.
Oh, dear. You must forgive her, Mr. Reeve. It's a difficult age, and of course she is rather plain at the moment, though the boys are very good-looking. She doesn't always behave like that. She's really quite playful sometimes.
Indeed.
I know you wouldn't think it, but really, I've known her pass the whole evening without mentioning a single book, or in fact anything unpleasant at all.
That must be an unusual experience.
Well, I expect you'd like to look round the garden, Mr. Reeve, and perhaps visit the church. The memorial bust of Richard is very nice. The moustache is almost exactly the same.
Ah.
But, of course, everyone was very upset he couldn't be buried there. But he had become a Roman Catholic, so it was...
My brother could always be trusted to join any fashionable movement, Mr. Reeve.
Oh, don't say that, Stephen. I'm sure he meant well. I dare say you'll come across some of the boys, Mr. Reeve. I have rather a house full of them at the moment.
You'd only ever understand him if, quite triumphantly, you understood the whole family as well. How those words of Mrs. Heppel in The Hot and the Cold came back to us there in Schoen's own native ambience. The sunlit summer fields he knew so well. His nephews and nieces with their precious heritage, not only of his home, but of his name.
Hello, sir. Are you Mr. Reeve?
Yes, I am.
How do you do, sir? I'm Brian Sherwin. Mother said you were coming.
How do you do?
This is my brother, George Sherwin, sir. How do you do, sir?
How do you do? You're not playing cricket with the others.
Not at the moment, no, sir. Where did you go after tea, Bri? I went off to the apple room to finish my lyrics.
I wrote 2 lyrics this morning.
Any good?
No, not very. Tore them both up.
What's yours like?
I've been trying a new kind.
Well, let's have a look.
No, haven't polished it yet.
Oh, I might be able to help.
No, thank you. And if it isn't any good, you won't see it at all.
No, squish.
Oh, sorry, sir. But it is, rather.
Did I hear you say you were writing? Writing?
Lyrics. Yes, sir.
Ah, yes.
We spend a lot of time during the summer writing lyrics.
Don't have much time during the term, of course.
No, of course not.
We aren't all that good at them yet.
Would you get a glance at some of them, Mr. Reeves?
Oh, come off it, George. We can't expect Mr. Reeves to be interested in that sort of thing.
No, I suppose not. Sorry, sir, I forgot.
No, my dear chaps, I'd be delighted to see them. I might even be able to place some of them for you.
Place them, sir?
Well, I mean, I know one or two publishers.
Oh, I see, sir. How jolly nice.
Of course, they're not much without the music.
The music?
Yes, our brother Owen does the music. Would you like to go up to the house and hear some?
Very much, yes.
Oh, his music is terrific.
A composer in the family as well.
Oh, yes. We must get him to sing Brian's latest for you.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, yes, but Brian's latest is terrific.
Oh, it's nothing really.
It's ever so good, sir. A good title, too.
What is its title?
Oh, it's just a piece called Don't Hurt My Heart.
Really? Ah, yes. Don't Hurt My Heart.
Shall we go up? We can go to the kitchen garden.
How very easily, how very lightly the young write of sorrow's touch. It seems that youthful genius has instinctively a knowledge of those depths which experience has not yet, thank God, led it to. How well Schoen himself understood this. How much he himself would have sympathized with the poetic precocity of masters Brian and George Schoen. Happily still with us.
Owen, can we come in?
Yes, come in. What do you want?
Owen, this is Mr. Reeve. He's writing a book about Uncle Dick. This is my brother, Owen Schoen, sir.
How do you do?
How do you do, sir?
Mr. Reeve wants to hear the new piece.
Yes, he wants you to sing Don't Hurt My Heart.
You mean you want me to? Don't you take any notice of them, Mr. Reeve?
No, really, I should be awfully pleased if you would play and sing for me.
Well, if you really mean it, sir.
Of course he does.
He wants to hear Don't Hurt. Come on, Owen.
Well, if you're sure.
Come and watch from this end of the piano, Mr. Reeve. You get the full effect from here.
I don't order Mr. Reeve about like that, Brian.
I'm sorry, sir. But really, it's smashing from just here.
Thank you.
Well, of course, Mr. Reeve, this hasn't really had the finish put on it yet, so you will bear that in mind, won't you, sir?
Go on, Owen.
Okay. And, of course, it isn't really much without the band parts. Still, here goes.
Jolly good chords, aren't they, Mr. Reeve?
Oh, why did you say that terrible thing? Can you have known the wound it would bring? Right in the midst of that wonderful spring, baby, you made me cry. Baby, don't hurt my heart, baby. Baby, don't make me sigh. Baby, don't make me smart, baby. Baby, don't make me cry. There are just a few things since the world began. You may not think it, but believe me, they can hurt so that even a big grown-up man, baby, just has to cry. Baby, don't hurt my heart, baby. Baby, don't make me sigh. Baby, don't make me smart, baby. Baby, don't make me. Baby, don't make me. How can you bear to? How can you care to? Baby, don't make me cry. Baby, don't make me cry this way.
Gosh, he's super.
Is he all right?
Yes, just give him half a sec to get over it.
Well, how'd I do?
It was super jolly,
dear.
Do you get real tears, Owen?
Well, look, am I wet or am I wet?
Gosh, real ones. Do you see, Mr. Reeve? He got real tears.
Yes, I could see he was greatly moved.
He really cried. There are only 5 people in the whole world who can do that, Mr. Reeve. Did you know? And none in England. I declare my brother to be top musical genius of all England.
Oh, come on.
Hooray! Let's all sing it. Yes, come on. Start it again, Owen.
Baby, don't hurt my heart, baby. Baby, don't hurt.
The fire of creative genius. It does not expire. Divided it may be, but it does not expire. In a sense, the best monument to Schoen's genius that can be imagined, and we are not forgetting the great bronze statue designed, but unfortunately never executed, by Mr. R. Everton Bunningfield, ARA. The best monument is in the thriving creative gifts so strikingly displayed by the Schoen nephews. A famous phrase from Schoen's last completed work comes to one's mind. We live in others. No one can read the moving passage in which it occurs without the ghost of the great novelist seeming to hover, perhaps with his familiar wry smile, over the page. Let us look at that page. It is the last scene from that final exquisite study in the ambiguity that attends all human relationships, the arse and the elbow. Roderick, the young and dissolute airman, has died in action. Grace, the girl he has possibly ruined, though we are left intentionally unsure of this, of course, talks in her distress to Father Tippett, the uncertain priest, who has, again a beautiful ambiguity, failed to save him. The two characters utter their elegy over him. It begins with Grace's pathetic cry,
"But what shall I do, Father Tippett?"
she asked.
"Go out and look for him, my child,"
he replied.
"Look for him, Father Tippett? Whatever do you mean? He's dead. Roddy's dead. How can you joke about such a thing?"
"We have all of us just died in some sense or another, my dear,"
he said.
"All of us,"
he added.
"All of us and all of the time,"
he went on.
"Throughout the whole of our lives," a great poet once said that. "At least, I suppose, he was a great one. I wouldn't know any longer."
"But, Father Tippett, what use is poetry to me now?"
"This poet, my dear, was a great sinner, you might say. But he was also a little touched with sanctity. Perhaps, who knows, all great sinners are."
"Oh, I don't understand all this, Father Tippett. I only know..."
She stopped, as if she didn't quite know what it was she only knew. The rain still poured down outside. It would already be flooding the Red Lamp District downtown. Father Tippett waited for her to go on. You had to wait with the young, however thirsty you were. You couldn't just send them away.
"I don't understand,"
she said.
"I don't understand,"
she repeated.
"None of us, except God, can understand everything, my child. And he, well, it's an old commonplace. We can only pray it's a true one. To understand all is to forgive all. And perhaps God forgives all."
Wondering what more there was to say, he scratched his groin furtively, then remembered and stopped. He looked down at the young, upturned face, and pity twisted his dry mouth and stomach. It doesn't matter if they are pasty-faced, so long as they're young. What a bad priest he was.
"Go out and look for him, my child."
He had said that before, but it was almost as if he wasn't saying the words himself.
"But where, Father Tippett? He's dead."
Suddenly, Tippett seemed to know what it was he had to say to her, though he couldn't possibly have told anybody why. He said,
"We live in others, my dear. And the greater we are, the more we live in them. And Roddy, our Roderick, well, our Roddy was perhaps a very great man indeed.
The end.
A Very Great Man Indeed was written by Henry Reed. The production was by Douglas Cleverdon. This was the cast: Herbert Reeve, Hugh Burton; Stephen Schoen, Carlton Hobbs; Connie Schoen, Gwen Cherryl; Muffy, a Pussy, Vivian Chatterton; the Mrs. Adler and Betty Berkeley, Jeanette Richer and Marjorie Westbury; Richard Schoen's valet, Frank Duncan; T.H. Powers, Norman Shelley; Lady Blackie, Betty Hardy; Hilda Tablet, Mary O'Farrell; Elsa Strauss, Marjorie Westbury; Miss Rich, Cecile Chevrolet; Nancy Schoen, Dorothy Primrose; Janet, her daughter, Gwen Cherryl; Owen, Brian and George, a few of her sons; Dennis Quilly, Anthony Reese and Marjorie Westbury. Schoen's narrative prose was read by Frank Duncan. The fragment of a piano sonata in the settings of Schopenhauer and Don't Hurt My Heart were composed and played by Donald Swan. The program was recorded. It was a new production of the program, which was first broadcast in September 1953.